My name is Jody and I'm an alcoholic.
And I don't want to do this.
But I've learned in this program that I need to do what it takes and I need to do what's suggested. And I would imagine this is one of those things that going to any lake involves for me, because it's not that I have any lack of conversation. It's just standing in front of all of these people. But when I look around, everyone in this room is a friend of mine. And that's something that I didn't have before. When I had my first drink, it was probably New Year's Eve, 1973. I was 14. I shared a bottle of champagne and a cannabis cigarette with three of my best friends, and we were ready to take on the world because we were going to high school next year. High school was great. College was great. I never had a problem with drinking when I was younger. I went to a party, occasionally we would drink, depending on what kind of party we went to, depending on where we went, when we went on vacations. If you went to the river, you drank a certain thing. If you went skiing, you drank a certain thing. It was all recreational. It wasn't a problem for me. When I got to be about 24, I met my husband. And he was a pretty good drinker also. He comes from an old San Francisco family who knows how to drink wine. And I learned how to drink wine as well. And I became very good at it. There's a lot of times that I would base what I would have to drink on what kind of a glass it came in. Because I liked the glass. And I have to say, at the end of my drinking, I still used the glass because I could drink a lot faster with the glass and I could shit out of the bottle. And that's where I went. When I was about 33 years old, I had so much control of my life that I had no more room for all the stuff that I didn't like because I was full. I started having problems with my health, and once I didn't have a grip on that either, everything came tumbling down. You know, it seems like as long as I was healthy and fit, I can control everybody else. But once I lost control of my own stuff, there was no way I could take care of everybody else's either. When I first started drinking, to feel better. I don't know exactly when it had changed me, but there was a point where I was drinking because it gave me some relief, a relief that I had felt in no other way. And it made me feel good. And it helped me get over the problems that I was facing for that day. I don't know when it changed. I can recall one time that I had hit a half a pint of vodka in my laundry room. And I knew that that was wrong because my stepmother had been an alcoholic and she used to like to hide bottles. And I still remember standing in that laundry room and looking at that bottle, and I don't remember what my excuse was, but it was really good. Why I could hide a vodka bottle and it was okay because I had a really good reason. I guess really that's when the denial starts, and it started for me now that I can look back. The first time I could look at it, that's where it was, but I didn't want to see it. Because I wasn't drinking for the same reason she was. She lost control. You know, and I was just a better person than she was, and so I would be able to handle all this because that's how I'd lived my life so far. My drinking got so bad in a very short amount of time, say 4 years. By the end of 4 years, I could get drunk and go to bed and stay in my room for a couple of days at a time. After about a year of staying in my room, I was trapped there. I know that I drank to escape. But what I know now that I drank and I became trapped. What happened to me from drinking was exactly the thing that I started drinking to get away from, and that's exactly the opposite of what it did for me. And I was trapped, and I didn't see it for a long time. I didn't want to see it. It didn't make any difference to me that my friends, I could hear my kids'
telling their friends all the time that their mom was sick, and I can remember their friends saying, God, your mom's sick a lot. That didn't faze me, because I was sick. I was miserable. What I found that alcohol did to me in this place where I could escape from is it stripped every kind of feeling that was actually genuine that I had left. I was so vulnerable. I just felt like a live wire for 3 or 4 years. It's like if you said something to me about my skirt, I would end up drinking over it because you said I was a shitty mother and my house was dirty and my car wasn't good enough. And that's one of the things that's actually changed for me today. When I have problems today or when I have emotions that are very difficult, I can just live with those emotions. I can actually just stand in them and have them. There was a time about almost 2 years ago now that I knew that I had a problem because things were starting to happen. I was working in Clovis at the time, and if I stopped on the way home at this one little liquor store, I could buy a half a pint and have a drink by the time I got home. That lasted for a few months, and that was really good because I could go home and go to bed. And after a while, that wasn't enough. I couldn't wait till the end of the day. And since I had my own office and I could close the door, I would start at noon. And after a while, that wasn't good enough either, so I'd pick up a bottle on my way to work, and then I could go out to lunch and get something else. And then I could still stop for that $1.99 bottle on the way home. The only reason that I could control my drinking because I only bought a half a pint at a time. If I bought more than that, I couldn't control my drinking. If I bought more than that, I knew I was going to get in trouble because I was going to get so drunk and so disgusting and so I would just pass out or black out. I knew that would happen. So some days I would go to the store 3 or 4 times for that little bottle. But I had a good reason for it. It was 2 years ago, Thanksgiving, and everyone had come to my house, my whole family. By this time, they were all such assholes, and they were all doing everything wrong to mess up my life. And I got through that last holiday without getting really drunk, and by the end of the night, I was drunk because then I have to clean up after all these pigs, and I was just sick of it. And I knew that night that something had to change. It was either them or me. And there were too many of them, so it had to be me. So I went to the Friday night meeting that was over at the Christian Lutheran Church, and I walked in there, and right away I saw someone that I knew that worked at my grocery store, so I got that real embarrassing thing out of the way right off the bat. Because that's what I was worried about at first, was running into someone who I would recognize or who would recognize me. So that happened, like, right away. And I lived through that night, so I figured, okay. I kept going back to that meeting for probably 5 or 6 Fridays. But I was under the understanding, because I'm so smart and intelligent, that I could just go sit in this room and find out what these people were doing, and I could just do it myself. And I couldn't get past step one, and I wasn't going to ask anybody because I'm too smart and I'm going to figure it out myself. And I never did. And eventually I stopped going to that meeting because I wasn't like them. And we had nothing in common. So over the next year, I tried to quit drinking a few times. And the last time, which was a real effort, I quit for about 5 weeks. Because at the end of this 5 weeks, I was going to give myself a reward. And I was going to go to San Diego for a couple of weeks. And I got into about the 4th week of my non-drinking, and my sister told me I couldn't come because she was moving into a new house. And she did that to me on purpose. So I got drunk. It was kind of good, though, that I had gotten drunk. because what happened next is sometimes humiliating, and thank God she has a sense of humor, because I can laugh about this myself. But about this time last year, I got through the 4th of July, and my friends who were so gracious, my neighbors left me like a half gallon of some Bacardi stuff in my refrigerator, so I drank it all the next morning so I could clean up the yard and the house. So by the time my husband got up at around noon or 1 o'clock, I was passed out in the backyard, and I was laying on my side in my lawn chair, and he left me there. And when I got up that night, I was striped. He had left me in the sun all day on my side, and I had a sunburn down half of my body, so I was red on this half and white on this half. And I couldn't explain my way out of it. There were a few times when I tried to quit drinking that my husband decided to also stop drinking. And he stopped drinking for about 6 months one time. And that was probably the worst 6 months of my life. He turned into such an asshole, and I couldn't wait for him to start drinking again, but he needed to show me how to do it. So he decided, since he could stop drinking for 6 weeks or so, that he could start again because he was controlling it and he was fine. But I had to stop. And I knew I had to stop. So he decided that since he could drink, he would start hiding bottles from me. So my new goal in life would be to get up in the morning and find the bottles that this genius thought he could hide from me. And I was good at it. So after my last test of trying not to drink, and this is towards the end of July, I knew at this one point after the sunburn, and I had gotten drunk one more time, and it was the first day of my son's first soccer practice, and my husband wouldn't let me go because I drank that morning and I took a nap and got up at 3 and I was fine. He said, "You're not going." And I was really mad at him, but I knew why I couldn't go, and I knew that it was my fault, and I knew I was in trouble. I said, that was one of those moments for me that God gave me back. I knew that I was in trouble. So I sat down with my husband that night, and I decided that I would go to rehab. And I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time because I was having all these problems with depression. And he suggested I go to Betty Ford, and I thought, great, I get to go to the desert and have a fucking vacation. Because that's what I needed. So I got on the phone, I did all the paperwork, I did the half-hour interview, I'm ready to go, they can't take me for a week. Great, I have time to shop, because I get to go to this cool place, I get to dress for dinner, I get to play tennis, get to go hiking, and they're going to fix me. So shopping only took about a day, and the next day I wanted to get drunk, and I did, because I couldn't wait a whole week, and I knew I was in trouble, and I knew I was going to lose my life in that one split second. It just came to me. I had this cold sweat rush go right through me, and I knew I wasn't going to make it till the end of the week. So I told my husband I was really scared, and he called Cedar Vista for me, and I checked in the next morning. That was the first day of the rest of my life, honestly. The way things worked out for me, you know, I was ready to go. I wanted to go. I didn't know what else to do, but I had felt so bad about myself and what I'd done to my family and my friends. That was the first time in my life I knew that I had to ask someone for help. The very first time. And that was actually even scarier than anything else that went with it. That I had to tell someone that I can't do this by myself. But I did it. When I was in rehab, I thought it was really interesting because every person that was a counselor there or every person that needed to spend time with me looked like someone I had known in my life that I had loved. It was really creepy. The counselor there that everyone hated the most looked like my best friend. And she kept saying every once in a while, if you like me, I'm not doing my job. I really like you. I felt really safe there. I learned a lot of things from a lot of other people that were there, and what was really interesting is a lot of the people that were in there were fighting a lot of denial every day, every minute of every day, and that's the first thing that I saw in other people. But when some of the stories started sounding like my life, like they do in meetings, you know, I think by the time I got to rehab, I was willing. And I was open to the possibilities. And that's really the only thing they asked me to do, is to be open to the possibilities. And I was ready. And it was easy for me. I stayed there for 19 days, but my insurance said I could stay for 4 or 5 more than that. And so they told me I could go, and I thought, you're not kicking. You're not telling me what to do again. I've got my life back. I need to do this. I'm going to fight for it. So I went home that night, and I called the insurance company and said, yeah, you can stay, blah, blah, this. And I went back the next day, and I told that counselor, I have another week here. She said, you're ready. You must go home. So I did, because she told me I was ready. I wasn't getting kicked out. But I was really pleased at myself because I had the strength and fortitude to fight for something that I thought that I needed. That was the first time. So it's been 316 days. And what I've learned in this program really has changed my life in every way. Sometimes I think that I come here for so many other reasons besides not drinking. But this last week has proven to me that sometimes I use this program because that's the only thing I want to do that day, is to have a drink. Sometimes it comes down to just the basic necessities. After all this time, I think that's not going to happen to me, and it was everyday stuff that hit me last week. It was the non-appreciation from the kids. It was the dirty house. It was me doing all the stuff and no one saying thank you. And I found myself diving into this place, and I went into my bedroom and I laid on my bed and I closed the door and I turned the light off and I laid in there for about 10 minutes. And all of a sudden this little ping goes off in my head. What are you doing? Because I was laying there being miserable, fighting this fight in my head against all these other people, and I wanted to have a drink. Because I knew what a drink would do for me and how quick it would do it, and that's what I wanted. I wanted out. Sometimes I think now that this program works for me for no reason. I like to say that, even though that's not true. But it's in my everyday life, and so sometimes when I'm not thinking about it, I'm hoping and I have faith that it works for me, and it does. I realized when I was laying there that that wasn't the place to be in, just for me laying there. It wasn't going to change anything, and the bottom line was that I know the truth. You know, that was a moment of truth for me. I didn't know it at the time. In fact, I didn't know it till this morning. And that was a moment of truth. And the fact is that I know what the truth is for me. The truth is I cannot take a drink. I've been running through that keep it simple phrase in my head, because every once in a while something goes back through my head that I've heard 100 times and it finally makes sense, because I can relate to that in some specific way. I couldn't figure out why I was feeling so miserable this last week, because what was happening was that in my sober life I was having feelings that I used to have when I was drinking. And that was scary, because I just thought those things were going to go away. I was on my way to the Alano Club this morning, and I was really glad that I had woken up in a good mood, because I knew that I had to come here and talk, and I was just feeling so bitchy all week. I'm thinking, thought I was going to get up here and rave. I didn't know how I would be today. You know, that was a couple of days ago. And I woke up this morning and I realized that I felt really good. And I was on my way to the Alano Club and I realized how grateful I was, because how this program works for me is that I have this experience and I walk through it. And what I have today is this calmness and this serenity that I can look back and see what I just went through. And a lot of times I understand why that happened, and I learn something from it. I never know it when I'm going through it, because that would be just too easy. And there's sometimes when I feel really bad or I feel beat up, and I know what the answers are, but that doesn't matter either. It makes no difference. I know that if I would have called other women in the program and complained, they would have just started laughing at me like they do sometimes when I'm talking about my stuff. It doesn't matter that it happens to everybody else, because in that moment, I was beating myself up and I was the first one to get the punch. I think this program has also given me, well, I don't think it. I know that I have a higher power today because of this program. And that was something that I was worried about the most, because the directions aren't written down anywhere for me. You know, this is something that I just kind of have to get. You kind of have to evolve into this openness and willingness to see what else is out there. And that's what I was afraid of, because I could learn or read how to do anything else, but this was out of my control. About the second week I was in rehab, we did this thing where, well, I'd had this dream the night before, and the dream was that I was in a setting, I was in a rehab setting group, and they were asking everyone to think of someone that you dislike immensely and think of something nice to say about them. And, of course, someone popped right into my head, and it was my brother's girlfriend. And I had to really think about it, and I decided that what I liked about her was that she had her own teeth. It's a start. It's the first thing I've ever been able to say nice about the girl, but it was a start, and that really made my heart feel good, because it was something, honestly. So I got up that morning and I was having breakfast, and I had told a couple of other people in my group about this dream, and we got into our first meeting that morning, and the Book of Reflections was talking about saying something nice about someone that you don't like. That was really creepy. That was the first little spark I had that there was a higher power in my life. And once I was able to see that thing, I was even a little bit more willing, because something had happened that I could understand. And the more I started looking, the more I could see. Oh, Sunday, February 28th, I was standing in my yard, and I was doing some gardening, and no one else was home but me, and the music was on, and all the flowers were starting to bloom, and I had things blooming that I'd had for 3 or 4 years that I hadn't been paying attention to, and they were blooming that year, this year. And I just started walking around my yard, and I stopped, and I looked around, and I realized that I was happy. And I started crying, and I realized that I wasn't alone. And I knew in that instant that I had a higher power. And I stood in my yard and I cried for like 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. I couldn't believe it. You know, that was the first time in many, many years I could say I liked my life and I was just happy just with what I had. Because I hadn't felt that way in a really long time. You know, I spent a lot of time in my drinking being disappointed. And I don't know how you'd get out of that. Well, I do now. But ever since that day, I knew that I would be okay. And what happens to me now and how it works to me now is I have these small moments of clarity and I have these small moments of serenity. And when they happen, it feels like I have this little cup inside of me or it's that rope. And all these little things start building up and now I have this knot at the end of my rope in my soul here. And when I need to hang on, I have something to hang on to and it keeps getting longer and stronger as time goes on. But I always have to pay attention to what's going on around me. And I always have to remember that I have to be honest with myself. And you know, that's just not always fun to do because you don't want to know the answer. Because it's not the answer that you want. Another thing that helps me out a lot is using the Serenity Prayer, because that usually cuts through a lot of the bullshit before I have to even take another step. That answers a lot of questions for me. I don't have to go past that. Saves a lot of time.
So today I'm living sober, and I'm very happy, and I still get really irritated with my family, but it's okay because I brought them up that way. To be spoiled and take and not do their stuff. Today I also have a lot of hope, and I have a lot of faith that this program has given me, and that really, you know, that's really the stones that start my new life, because I have those things today, and there's a lot of times that I can't be grateful enough, because occasionally gratitude just doesn't cut it. There's been a lot of times in this program for me that I could go weeks and weeks on gratitude. I could just fly. And my best friends lost their only son a few weeks ago. And he was 20 years old, and he was a beautiful kid, and he was just gone. And in dealing with that, there were times that I just couldn't be grateful enough. It didn't help enough. And it was really interesting because when I first got this word, you know, my first reaction was to have somebody to blame. And I tried really hard to blame God. I happened to be in Bakersfield when I got the news, so I had that drive home before I could head to Santa Barbara where we were going. And I was yelling and screaming in my car, and I really wanted to blame God. But I know today that that's just not the truth. The truth for me is that God can't always stop what happens to you, and the God that I believe in just helps me figure out how to get through it. You know, there's no answer, there's no right answer, there's no rhyme or reason for why this great kid had to be taken. So to me, that really doesn't matter too much. That's not my job. My job is living through this. And the amazing thing about all of that was that it was probably the first time in my life that I could actually just be sad and I could mourn a loss and not have all this other minutia feeling crap jump into there and mess it up. You know, when I was drinking, if I got bummed out about something, all this other stuff would flood in there. And then I was screwed. You know, there's no way I could fix this when I got 50 stuff over here to get to first. And I would be trapped there. And that didn't happen to me this time. And I realized that there was some, you know, a lot of grace that came out of this for me because I could be there for my friend. And the thing that was scary for me now is because my friends don't have what I have. And I'm worried about my friends. But what I know about this program today is I can call them today, even though it feels awkward, and say to them, I don't have anything to say. I was thinking about you and I just wanted you to know. It's a lot easier to walk around white elephants. I don't know whoever said that, and I don't think it's true today, but we do it. We do it every day. And I got to a point in my drinking that I couldn't do that anymore, especially in my family dynamics. I couldn't walk around those white elephants because there was no place left for me to walk. I like being powerless today. Because when I can say that I'm powerless over something, there's something that happens that gives me a lot of strength. After I say I can't fix this, I get a lot of strength. There's something very soothing about me knowing that all I can do is be there if I need the help. But I didn't know that before. I thought I was supposed to fix everything. So I'm glad I don't have that job anymore. I go to a meeting every day if I can, because that's how it works for me also. I always find it amazing, and I like to tell newcomers that, you know, just keep sitting in these rooms, because there's going to be a day when someone stands up who has not a clue what kind of life you have. And you can look at them and say, we have absolutely nothing in common, and that person describes how you feel in your life. That's how it works for me. Sometimes I have to just sit and listen, and so I do that. And I thrive off the experience of other people. That's what keeps me going, because I don't know how to do this. And I'm not afraid to say I don't know how to do it anymore, because the only way I can do a good job is to get some help. So I'll keep coming back, and thank you all for being here.
I'm an alcoholic. I'm real glad to be here. I enjoy my life of sobriety. And the big reason that I can enjoy it is because of people like you. Normally I say around these tables, but around these chairs. One of the problems when I speak, I always feel a little guilty. When I was growing up, I always looked at my teachers. I did a little study of music privately, too, and I'd always look at them, and I'd look at the preacher, and I'd always feel like, God, these guys got to be perfect, you know. They're really something. And because they were up in front of me, and that's how I feel with this Alcoholics Anonymous speaking. I love to speak. But sometimes I think that people see, look at that guy, you know, he's got it all together, he's no problems. Well, before I start, I want you to know that I have some major problems. I have some big problems. The one thing that I'm really satisfied with, but I still keep working on it, and that is my sobriety. You know, March the 3rd of 81. Hey, I'm proud of that. There are other parts of my life that I'm working on, and they'll come along okay, too. I'm 72 years old. Come September, I'll have been married to the same lady for 50 years. And I got to tell you, that's not my fault. Okay, I'm a little bit proud of it because whenever I get home at night and evening, she's always there. So I always figure, well, I must be doing something right, huh? I have two children, my son Jay, who's with me tonight, his wife Emma Jane, and they have three children, and I love them to pieces. I have a daughter, 9 years younger than Jay. Husband, and they have two children. And I think if I were to add everything up, I gotta tell you, I think the grandchildren cost us more money than the kids did, you know. So you can see I've got a very nice life. I grew up in Chicago. My father was a clergyman. He had a mission on Lincoln and Diversey. And I'm talking about a mission, okay? He was there for 27 years. And never had any alcohol in our house. Never. Anybody should be sober, it should be me, but the disease didn't tell me that. Mm-hmm. I grew up, I had a mom, she just loved me to pieces and she just did everything. I don't remember even making a bed till after I got married, you know, she did it all. She did it all. And I'll tell you, she watched me when I dated, she wanted to know, who is this girl? Where does she live? What did her parents do, you know? I remember one time she said, how come you always come around here with these chubby little girls? And I said, well, Ma, I like them that way. You know? I like them that way. You know? My dad, he told me everything. My father told me everything. Showed me how to play baseball. Showed me how to throw a curb. He showed me how to drive a car. And when I was of age, he gave me a set of keys. And man, that was really something, you know. My own set of keys for the car, which happened to be a 54-door Chevy with those lights on the fender. You remember, don't you? Sorry. Oh, it was sharp. And as long as I behaved myself and Mom didn't need the car, then, yeah, I could use it. It was great. Went through high school. got a job at a radio station in Chicago. Went to a conference with my father, and I met my father's best friend's daughter. You know how those things go, huh? Oh, God, she's a dandy. She really looked neat. I fell in love. And started writing the letters. And from Chicago to South Dakota, where the conference was, it was 600 miles. It took me 12 hours to drive it. And things got going pretty good. 2 years after we met, we got married. Now, doesn't that sound like a good start? No money, but we got married, you know. And things really went along fine. And worked for a radio station. That was before the compulsory health and accident programs had to come in, where they had to buy you hospitalization. And we had our first baby 2 years after we were married, and the baby died. And that was tough on both of us. And because we didn't have insurance, the bill was very high. And we had to pay that ourselves. So we got that done. But I had to get a part-time job. And then I left the radio work and went in the insurance business. Did very well in the insurance business. No $1 million, but always had a couple of dollars in my pocket. After working there for a while, the sales manager invited us all over to his house for a promotion. Out of the 20 salespeople that were there, there was about 5 of us, I guess, that were getting our own territory to develop on. Went over there, and his apartment in Chicago was an apartment on a 32 floors up, in an all-glass apartment building. You could see out, but you couldn't see in. It was fantastic. It was just a dream, you know. We went up there and had dinner, and it was beautiful. It was in a December. And overlooking the downtown area in Chicago with all the lights glistering and the Lake Michigan, man, it was beautiful. Standing there with a little kid that never had a dime really, and all of a sudden all this stuff, just great, it was beautiful. And he gave us a promotions, told us what area we would have, and I don't know if my wife ever knows this yet, but she'll find out tonight. He gave us, I think it was $300 bonus. And he says, you put this in your pocket, you don't have to tell your wife about this, this is your money. I spent it already, hon. Okay, I spent it already. He said, because you know this money, it gives you power. You got money, you got power. He gave us that talk. He said, okay, you guys, get out of here now. Go home. And see you at work tomorrow morning. He said, before you leave, I'll buy you a drink. Or give you a drink. I'm looking at my wife. And he says, come on over here.
And he went back to the wall, and he pulled back this folding, like Prince George, you know, to pull it back. And I look and I see a bar back there it's filled with booze, you know. Now, here's a guy I honestly don't remember of ever drinking. Now, I'm sure somewhere along the line I had swallowed beer, or glass of beer, something, I don't know. But I don't really remember it. So that means it didn't come out and grab me and didn't matter. Well, he pours the guys a drink, and he says, John, what are you going to have? I said, I don't drink. What do you mean you don't drink? That I don't think. Come here, I'll teach you. Yeah? And I'll never forget. He took 2 glasses. He was a little Italian guy with a strong, you know, this kind of, you know, 2 glasses. And he never even looked. And he just goes like this, comes up with a bottle, and I still see the bottle at the Chevis Regal. And he goes, you know? And man, oh man, what's this guy going to strike? He said, that's yours.
I'm going to do this. Hold it. You have to marinate this SOB. You can't just drink it like that. Well, okay, whatever you say. So I see him standing there like this, you know. So I'm standing over here and I'm going like this. Well, I'm glad you're laughing now, because from here on, baby, it's... Never get it. Now just taste it. Don't swallow it. Just slowly sip it. And I picked up that scotch and I slowly sipped it. And man, I want to tell you something. I fell in love. And these people that walk around knowing all about booze and everything and say you have to acquire a taste for scotch, they ain't gonna have a clue, you know. They don't have a clue. Because the first sip I had, and that disease of alcoholism had me. I mean, it had me. I remember going home that night, my car, after I had a couple more, I don't remember how many. I'm driving my car. I said, I wonder why my mother and dad always told me, don't fool around with booze, women, or cigarettes. You know? That's what my mother used to tell me. Don't fool around with the booze, with the girls, the cigarettes. Leave us alone. I'm like a good son. I say, yeah, you know. I wonder why she said that about booze. I went home, and 2 weeks later, there was a private tea club on the south side of Chicago where we were living at the time. And I had gone in there and done some business with him. The man had bought a little insurance for me. Joined this key club. The company paid for the key club because they'd bought insurance. And I had gone out there open every Friday night. Well, customer. What? What? Customer. Look, I want to see my customer, you know. Have a couple of scotches and go home. All of a sudden I found out, by golly, they're open on Wednesday too. You know? So that nobody should be in there trying to sell my customer insurance on Wednesday. You know, I was there to protect my interests, you see. You understand that, don't you? It was 2 years from that point in time that I had trouble going home with money in my pocket. And things didn't get better at home. And I really wanted to quit. I knew this was heading downhill. And I was on an elevator, and baby, that thing was going down, and I didn't want to, and I didn't have enough brains to get off. So I just held on to that Chevy's Regal, and I let it fly. About 2 years later, I knew something had to give. I was running out of stories, telling my wife, why do I smell like fools? And this idea of having a couple of beers, you know, wasn't going over too good, but I didn't admit that I was having a problem with alcohol. I could have told her, she'd have done everything she could to help me. I could have told my dad. He would have cut his arm off like that here to help me. But I'm typical alcoholic. I'll do it my way. You get the hell out of here. I'm going to handle this thing. I got stuck downtown Chicago one winter, twice. It snowed in and couldn't. My office was in the loop. If you've ever been in Chicago, you're in there and something happens. No streetcars, no cabs, nothing was going. And I remember I had to stay down there for the night, overnight, so I went to get a room at the motel. And by golly, they laughed at me, when they said, wait a minute, these rooms have been filled since 12 o'clock. Other people were smart. They knew it was coming, so they got their room early. So I said, well, there's a couch back in the office. I'll go back there. And when I got there, there were about three people already on the couch, so I got sleep on a step, you know, with my coat as a pillow. Anyway, weather broke about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. I don't remember. Anyway, I went home and I walked into the bedroom with my little briefcase and I closed it and I said, Florine, we're moving to California. She said, where? The only town I knew in California is where she was born, and the name of that town was Dinuvis. I said, we're moving to Dinuvis. She said, oh, great, go home. No, but even in my dumb stupor alcohol user, God still had his way. And incidentally, that's my higher power. I share that with you. I hope you don't mind my taking a good hunk of him. Lorraine's uncles owned, or cousins or whoever they were, owned the radio station in Dinuvis, and I got a job there. It was really a godsend, KRDU and 98.9. Soft rock now. They sold it. They don't own it anymore. But came out here in 1958. And can you believe it? I never touched another drop of alcohol. Never came up. For 4 years. Never drank. And I'm going, man, you know, I knew I could handle it. I knew I could do it. And things were going pretty good. I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making a couple of dollars. And back there, 1958, or 62, somewhere in there, you know, for $500 down, you could buy a little house, and you could rent it out and have a cash flow. And I'm half Jewish, so you can tell here. Anyway, we bought a few of them, and man, things were going good, and people started saying, hello, Mr. Mendel. And then, who's he? Oh, yeah. And made a lot of friends. My advertising representing the station is doing very well. Boss is very happy. And it's a December, 4 years later. Here comes my friend, says Johnny. There's four of us meeting right here in the corner, Tulare and L. And we're going to go have a little potty, and I want you to come along. And well, thank God, you know, 4 years? Hey, 4 years? Ha! Can I handle that? Huh? And don't forget, at 4 o'clock, I'm standing right around the corner. Here they come. Four guys in a car, open the door, in I get. Going down El Monte. You know Mount Dinuvis, Mountain View? Going out towards Kingsburg, or going out to 99 and something, says, John, get this car stopped. Get the hell out of here. Get out of the car. So what's the matter with you? Tell these guys, I'm going to get out of the car. We're driving 60 miles an hour down. Got to Highway 99, going north. Something says, why don't you just step out? Lie a little bit. Get out of here. I said, nah. Up 99. Beautiful Bruce's Lodge with the airplane in the window. In the room. Remember that? Remember that? Oh, man. They pull in. Something says, call Floreen. Tell her to come and get you. Or walk home. I said, you know, I'm going to walk home from Selma to Dinuvis, or I'm going to call my wife, my little lovely Mennonite little wife, to come and get me from Bruce's Lodge. You know, that's what you want me to do. And I said, no way, I ain't going to do it. I can handle this. Walk in and we sit down by the bar. Rocky comes up to me and says, what the hell are you doing here? He knew me. He knew us because I used to go in there and eat the rigatoni and pickled pig feet. Have you ever had those there? Oh, man, I'll tell you. Yeah, they're delicious. And he had offered us wine before, and I said, oh, no, I don't drink. We don't drink. And he said, what are you doing here? I said, what the guy's going to drink? I said, do you have Chivas Regal? He says, yeah, does a bear live in the woods? That's not what he really said. But he says, not only that, John, the other guys had already gone. Oh, and we rolled, and I lost for the 6 drinks. He looked at me, and he says, I have a special scotch for you, John. He went back, and you know, Chivas Regal has a 12-year-old, and then, what is it, they have 18-year-old or the 24, what is it? It's a better quality scotch. And he stepped that sucker right in front of me, and he poured me a scotch, and he said, John, yours is on me. I was with two of my best, well, the one guy is still my best friend, he's still my insurance man, and has no idea of the story I'm just telling you. I drank that scotch on the rocks. And finally, I didn't care anymore, and I started going to the smokehouse and all the rest of them. And my boss came up to me and said, John, something's wrong. Something's wrong. Your production is way off. And he says, I'll give you about 48 hours to get it back to where it's supposed to be. And I said, what if I can't? He says, then I'll help you. And I knew what that meant, you know. Like, adios. I had a very good friend here in Dinuba, one of the very well-known businessmen who had been offering me a job for about a year because I handled his advertising. This man's name was Arnold Weedy. I went over there and I said, Arnold, were you kidding about a job? He said, hell no, come on. More money, farther away from home, huh? More excuses for those couple of beers that my wife was asking me about. And I mean to tell you, those apartments, first thing we had, slowly we're selling them. I'm never home. My wife is sick and I'm sicker than all of them. And we really didn't know where to go. You see, we didn't know about AA. I'm gonna start crying, I don't wanna. We didn't know about AA. My wife didn't know about Al-Anon. Okay? And she needed it bad. How come you're like this? So finally my wife says, enough is enough, and my son was begging me to stop drinking. Took some classes at Fresno State after he got out of Reedley on alcoholism. Came up to me one day and says, there's a rehab in Madera. You know, you guys were at the Pine then, weren't you, in 81? And I know somebody mentioned that, and I said, oh, God, I don't want to go there because if people see me, they think I'm an alcoholic or something, you know. God forbid that should happen, Frank, you know. Anyhow, some way, somehow, they got me up there. And they got me in the bed. And the reason they got me up there is because they took me up on a Saturday, or was that Friday? Friday. Took me up there. Took me through the comp care. Asked me, can you handle it? I said, I think so. She said, when? I said, I'll let you know. The next day I went to work. We used to have, the first day of the month, we used to have a meeting and would plan the advertising. I did all of his advertising. Any spot you ever heard, I did it for him. And went to this meeting first of the month, and I disagreed with him on something. And with Weedy, you never do that. You never disagree with him. Anyway, we got back to the office. My office, right, the first one as you come in the door, and he came up to me and he said, sir, you don't like my idea. You don't think the way I'm running this place is good. I said, that wasn't what I was saying. You don't want everybody to say yes to you, and I think you're wrong with you. Boom. Now, this guy was a good friend of mine. I mean, I'd gone to meetings with him for General Motors all over, you know, and he's stunning. I'm going, there's something wrong. I look at him, and he's standing there like this. You know? And I said, oh, man, he's had a few, because we were at the breakfast at the Flame, and we had some screwdrivers. He must have had a few more than I did. So I stood up, and all of a sudden I'm saying to him, you know, I'm the same way. And you know, that was God's moment right there. My wife and my children had prayed for old dad, and the iron was hot, and I have a good idea. The Lord had a sledgehammer in his hand, and man, he just popped me right into the world of wanting to get sober. And then, of course, all of a sudden, I'm taking control, and I call my wife, and I says, call him up at Madera and tell him we'll be up tomorrow. She almost flips her lid, wondering what the heck's going on. And I said, no, call him, I'm coming up tomorrow morning. So she calls up there and says, well, we want to bring my husband in tomorrow morning. They said, we're all filled up. So she calls me back. She says, they're all filled up. I said, well, call them back and tell them I'm coming anyhow. I'll be there tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I have to sleep on the steps. I'll do it. So she calls back up there, and they said, well, if he wants it that bad, bring him in. We'll do something. Now I go in and I tell him, that was just when Putnam Wynn bought the place, too. They were all there. I went in and I said, hey, you guys, I got enough of this alcohol business. I'm drunk. I just signed myself into comp care in Madera. I'm leaving. I'll see you guys in 30 days. And they surrounded me. I couldn't believe it. They said, God bless you, you're doing the right thing. Take this car, the demo, give it to your wife, let her drive it. You need money. What do you need? I made a mistake when I said, you need money. I said, no. Yeah, I'll never do that again. I should have said, yes, but I did it. And they took me. I walked out. She calls again. She said, I'm coming down to get you. I said, I'm not coming down to get you. I'll be home. Hang up. A minute later, again, you know, they had the car dealers there all the time. They announce your name over the PA. Johnny Mal, calling it. I said, hi. She said, I'm coming out. I said, no, I'll be right home. I'm coming home. Come home myself. I don't need you around here. Don't call me. Call me again. I'm not going to go. Hang up. So, yes, she didn't go. So I close up my desk. I give a couple of deals that I had working on to another guy. We share the commission and stuff. And I walk out the door, get into my car, and I'm going, by golly, I better go over and see Chips. He owned the retreat farm, remember what I'm saying, next to the Hong Kong. I said, I better go over there and tell him, you know, I'm going to be gone for a month. After all, you know, he's a real good friend of mine. And not only that, he bought a Lincoln for me, and he bought one for his wife. And these things are, you know, business you've got to take care of. I go over, and I walk in. And when I walk in, he'd always automatically put up a glass red and the double scotch on the rocks. And I said, no, I'm going to rehab. I've got to do something about my drinking. Chip says, you're right. He says, you better get here. Have this drink, and we'll see you later. He gives me the drink, and I drink it, and I take off. Hey, this is true. Now, I'm going out of the retreat right next to the Hong Kong. I should embarrass Willie Lum and not go say goodbye to him? I mean, that just don't make sense. So when I go to Willie Lum and I say, in fact, I think Chunky was working there at the time. I don't know. Anyway, same thing. I'm going to rehab. And he says, not have it. Well, good grief. What about the guys at the depot? What about old John Martin, you know, the Vintage Press? I mean, after all, these are nice people. That was 10 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't the monkey's eye then. I don't know what it was. Some other name, Marco Polo, down Highwood Road 80 into Dinuba. I should not stop at the smokehouse. Andy, good friend. I did miss, somebody asked me if I missed Less and Lose the other day. Who did that? I missed Less and Lose, by golly. So, I want you to know that I was the greatest evangelist for rehabs that day. Because every place I went, I'm going to rehab, Comcare, and I'm going to... Well, I did that at the last place I was, and that was the Roots Club in Dinuba. And the next thing I know, the bartender got up and came around, and he said, you no good son of a... And he picked me up, and he walked me to the back door. And he says, you get out of here, and you never, ever come back to my bar again. He said, I owe you money. Oh, I don't give it. What am I going to do? 1:30 in the morning, I should fight with the guy? I got home. Ladies and gentlemen, here comes the good part. I got into bed the next morning. Of course, I had a drive to Madeira. You know, God forbid, to see somebody else driving my car, my wife, and got in there, and they put me into detox. I got out to go to the bathroom, and I slipped on my own waist and fell. They put up the things in the side of my bed. Some idiot AA guy came along and threw me a book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm not going to tell you what I told him, but one thing that bugged me and I loved was that I had watched Frank and his wife. They don't know this. I never told them. And I knew it could be done if I could get the right connection. What's the guy's name? He worked at Weeby Stewie's up at the Alana Club a lot. He had a stroke. I have permission to use his name, I can't think of it now. Somewhere along the line, I knew I was done for. I knew it was all over with. And I laid there 4 o'clock that morning. And I lay there and didn't know what to do. Incidentally, I had hidden $40 in the crotch of my shorts so that I could, as soon as I sober up, go catch the 99, you know, right just by the community hospital, Madera Community Hospital. So I don't know, that's where I was. I figured I'll fix him. Something happened to me. And I remember Clyde. I remember seeing Clyde at parties, and I wasn't drinking. I knew a few other AA people, didn't realize that they were AP. But he was telling me, ask God to help you. Laying in my bed that night, I made a commitment. I looked up through the ceiling, up into the sky, and right into the heaven and into God's face himself, and said, God, you give this old cotton-picking guy, John, another chance, I'll do the best. And all of a sudden, a new world. Honey, come on up here. Bring that article on the program. Come on up here. Something happened. I made a commitment. And I had assurance of the commitment that I would have help. I didn't know what. Once you read that article that's in the pipeline, just listen to
it. You saw it today. You don't put down with it. I've never read this before today. I'm your disease. I hate meetings. I hate higher powers. I hate anyone who has a program. To all who come in contact with me, I wish you suffering and death. Allow me to introduce myself. I am the disease of alcoholism. I am cunning, baffling, and powerful. That's me. I have killed millions, and I'm pleased. I love to catch you with an element of surprise. I love pretending that I'm your friend and your lover. I have given you comfort, have I not? Wasn't I there when you were lonely? When you wanted to die, didn't you call on me? Wasn't I always there? I love to make you hurt. I love to make you cry. Better yet, I love when I make you so numb you can neither hurt nor cry. You can't feel anything at all. This is true glory. I give instant gratification, and all I ask of you is long-term suffering. I've always been there for you when things were going right in your life. You invited me in. You said you didn't deserve these good things, and I was the only one who would agree with you. Together we were able to destroy all things good in your life. People don't take me seriously, but they take strokes and heart attacks seriously, even diabetes. Fools that they are, they don't know that without my help, these things would probably not be possible. I am such a hated disease, yet I do not come uninvited. You choose to have me. So many have chosen me over reality, peace, and serenity. More than you hate me, I hate all of you who have a 12-step program. Your programs, your meetings, and your higher power make me sick and weaken me and don't let me function in the manner I am accustomed to. Now I must lie here quietly. You don't see me, but I am growing, bigger than ever. When you only exist, I may live. When you live, I only exist. But I'm here. And until we meet again, if we meet again, I wish you continued suffering and death.
It's in the pipeline. Let me tell you something. I say I'm going to go a little bit over time in a couple of minutes ago. I can only tell you what happened to us. And I'd be less than candid if I didn't tell you everything, if I left something out. My acceptance and asking God to come back and be a part of my life was primary. I'm old-fashioned. You know, I had this old mommy who used to ask me, what girl are you dating and stuff like that. And so I'm old-fashioned. I believe in Jesus, and I talk to him, and he goes upstairs to the Father, and he says, hey, that's my buddy down there, John. Help him out. And he's done it. But only because I asked. A power greater than myself. And without that, there's nothing. Once you get that, you've got to hang around with other people who are like you, who are like me, alcoholic. And bind together. And I was, I hate meetings. Boy, I hated you guys when I first got out of there. That's some guy with red hair and smoking a pipe and you'd be alcoholic, you're the right person. But you know what? Now I'm looking back, this guy really liked me. You know, he really liked me. I wish I could find him now. I was at next to the Blackbeards up there. There's a little taco spell. They went broke and they had meetings in there. But that guy liked me. Let me tell you something. If Frank were just to hang by himself, to hang by yourself, it's like taking one tree and putting it on the top of the mountain. Just one tree and let it stand there. You know how long it'll last? The first windstorm and that sucker's gone. You know? What happened? There's just not one tree there. There's hundreds and thousands of trees. And in the ground, the roots of these trees are bound and tied together with each other. And let the wind come. Let the hailstorms come. Let the rain come. Everything, let it come. Oh, Frank and John are going to be standing there. And we ain't going to have a beer bottle in our hand either.
Now, if you be alcoholic and you want sobriety, get your higher power, I would recommend God, and take it one day at a time. The book says, in chapter 5, alcohol is too much for you. You can't do it by yourself. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. But there is one that can help. That one is God. Thank you.